Welcome to our annual teleconference on e-commerce research 2006 trends and data. This is Ann Holland. I'm the publisher of Marketing Sherpa. And with me today is Stefan Tornquist, our research director. Hello, Stefan.
Hello, Ann.
You should have downloaded a copy of our presentation before you started this MP3 file. If you haven't had a chance to download it, click on the link to download that. It is a PDF of our PowerPoint slides. And you can print that out, you can share that link with your colleagues and share the printout with them as well. On page one, you'll see what both Stefan and I look like. And then moving to page two, we have a description of where we get the data from for our benchmark guides. Stefan, can you talk us through where the data that we're going to be presenting today came from?
Absolutely. Well, the most important places we get data are from primary research studies. Many we do ourselves, like the eye tracking or survey of e-commerce marketers. But we also do partnered studies, and in this book we did a survey of consumers who were online shoppers, over 1,100 of them, in cooperation with Directions Research. We also look at all of the e-commerce data that's out there, all of the secondary data, and we look for the best of. We import it into the book, and we talk to it. We try to put it in the whole context of our finding. This time around, I think we had 94 sources for that secondary information.
That's great.
And finally, we use the anecdotal evidence that comes out of the interviews and case studies that you and the editorial team generate, and we don't so much reprint those in the book as we use those as guidance for what's really happening out there in the industry, places to go and research, etc., although we certainly do use some examples in the book.
I'd like to give a personal call out. If you are listening to this and you are one of the 1,100 e-commerce marketers who answered our call asking for your data and you took our survey that helped us create this guide, thank you very much. And we will be presenting some of the data that you helped us with today. Why don't we move on to page number 3 in our presentation. This is the first chart. This is a general overview. This is a very good overview chart. This is e-commerce growth for the past year. Now, Stefan, can you explain what the call-out is? What is the difference between the top chart and the bottom chart?
Absolutely. Well, in the top chart, we see how online retail is still booming in comparison with retail sales. Retail sales themselves were healthy overall for the year, but as you can see, online is still far outpacing traditional retail because it's so much smaller and growing so quickly. And one thing to remember when we look at these companies in the bottom chart, this is the spread of companies whose orders are growing by various percentages, that e-commerce, you know, they're new companies getting into it all the time. So while the industry as a whole is growing at 25%, and certainly there are those e-commerce marketers who are doing so as well, since so many new organizations are coming into e-commerce still, you know, one wouldn't necessarily expect to see 25% growth. It, of course, matters very much by vertical and other factors. But this breakout shows us that while a little under half, about 5% fewer than half of the companies saw a growth in orders of over 20%, the majority did not. Now, one thing also to remember is that while growth in orders is a decent proxy for how an organization is doing, this is the internet, and there are certainly a lot of companies who still have a business plan of taking over a share of the market at fairly low profitability. So it's not a direct proxy for profitability, but it's a number that we're able to get at much more easily since profitability is so closely held within organizations.
Okay, so in English, if I'm working for the marketing department, and I'm not a research expert, basically what you're saying is if I'm not making more than, I mean, if our orders didn't go up more than 20% last year, first of all, I'm actually an average. I'm doing okay. My site is not a total loser. I'm not doing a dreadful, dreadful job just because I didn't go up by more than 20%. There's plenty of other marketers who were growing as fast as I did. And also, if I didn't grow so incredibly quickly, it may have been because I chose as a marketer to be more profitable and to ratchet down perhaps spending that would have brought in a whole lot of sales, but maybe it cost me so much for the sales that we didn't end up being profitable. So slower growth can sometimes be more profitable.
Oh, that's absolutely right. However, we did use this high growth metric as a proxy for how companies are doing, and we'll see in this presentation and throughout the e-commerce guide that we use those high growth marketers as a point of comparison with the average.
Cool. All right, well, let's move on to page number 4. This is, of course, the chart everyone's dying to know about, which is out of your total budget, out of your total marketing budget, if you're an e-commerce marketer, where are you putting the money? How are you slicing the pie? And, of course, here you're we're showing two different bars. One of them is the top one, which is the darker bar, which are those high-growth folks. Those are the people who are growing by at least 20% in revenues, overall revenues per year, e-commerce revenues. And the bottom bar, which is the lighter bar for each one of these categories, are the folks who are growing, who have flat or declining orders. And what's interesting here is that there is a real difference in their budgeting tactics.
There absolutely is. The most interesting is one that underlies all of these numbers, because when we look at these individual tactics, we get averages for each one individually and then combine them to create this chart. So that's why you see that high growth marketers appear to spend more than more than 100% and more on each individual tactic. They don't, on a percentage basis anyway, but what they do is focus more resources on a smaller number of tactics. For instance, if a high-growth marketer is in search and in email, they're likely to spend higher percentages of their budget than the flat and declining orders folks on those tactics. Of course, they may not be doing something else, such as web ads or comparison shopping engines.
Now, I was always surprised by how little people are spending in comparison shopping engines. And one of the reasons traditionally has been, of course, that you're traditionally only been able to bid in some of the bigger comparison shopping engines by category. So you couldn't really break out your bidding by key term. You couldn't get really niche with it, which of course meant you might end up paying a lot more than you want to for a lot of the terms. So a lot of e-retailers just pull it out of all the categories altogether. Recently, there has been a movement in the e-commerce and the shopping comparison sites to actually allow you to bid by SKU, which, you know, is going to be amazing. I think that that's going to change the budgeting here, and I think we may see a significant change over the next year, because that will actually make it much more profitable and safer to go into comparison site search marketing. So although this is the lowest here, I wouldn't say that this is going to be dropping off forever. The other thing that I thought was interesting when I looked at some more of your data, Stefan, was that folks who are super, super heavy search marketers, because I know you had broken these numbers out again by the folks who are just spending an insane amount on search, and they tended to be spending a lot less on affiliate marketing. In fact, they were spending about half of what the average marketer was spending on affiliate marketing. So it seemed like if you ratcheted up your search marketing, it sort of meant you were taking away affiliate marketing from the affiliates. You were, in a way, taking it in-house. So that has real implications for the future of affiliate marketing.
That's absolutely right. And we've seen other data to corroborate that retail marketers, especially while the model of a few years ago might have been to use their affiliates essentially as an outsourced search provider, because so many affiliates are quite advanced in using search marketing. So retailers were willing to allow them to use trademark terms and branded terms. And really, with the incredible growth in search and so much research coming about efficacy, I think a lot of marketers saw those sales as really being sort of redundant. Those are sales that happen on the website if they placed enough emphasis on search themselves. Mm-hmm. And then you see that happening. Their willingness to allow those trademark and branded terms has dropped markedly in the last 18 months.
Cool. Now, one last thing to look at on this chart, which is take note of how much marketers are putting toward their own website, and I'm assuming also perhaps microsites and landing pages are probably lumped into that website figure. It tends to actually be one of the largest slices of your marketing budget. Now, later on in this presentation, we're going to talk about what actually is most effective thing to do on your website, what's really working. So take note of how important that budgetary figure is. Now, why don't we move on? And, of course, this next slide on page 5 of the presentation is the first of our two eye-tracking studies. People love the eye-tracking studies. Very briefly, if you have never attended a Marketing Sherpa presentation like this before, eye-tracking is we actually use eye-tracking labs. What happens is consumers, actual people on off the street come in, they sit down at what looks like a regular computer, they're sitting in a regular chair, there's no headset, there's no fancy, nothing weird going on, nothing that would skew the results. And it appears to be a tiny webcam kind of perches on top of the screen, and their mouse is wired so that the computer system notices what their mouse is doing. the tiny, tiny camera, though, can actually track what their eyeball is doing, where they're looking, how long they're looking, and, of course, then we're tracking where they're clicking and how far down they're scrolling. All of this information about what people are doing is translated here into what's called a heat map. Now, the cool thing about heat maps is, okay, not only are they extraordinarily fun to show in presentations and very high impact, they're also extremely useful when it comes to web design. If you're having any sort of in-house battles or big decisions about, okay, we want to change our nav bar, or we want to move, make images bigger or smaller on the page, or this really needs to be above the fold, and you're fighting out what needs to be above the fold, eye tracking can help you make very fast decisions about this stuff based on what human behavior tells you. Most humans' eyes are hardwired to behave, to look at a computer screen in roughly the same way. So you can just use, you know, I think we used maybe 30 people to look at these screens, and we had enough evidence from that to actually be very statistically accurate and draw out conclusions that could affect millions of people on the web. So it's a very nice, neat tool. I'm not saying it's the end-all and be-all. We love web analytics. We love multivariate testing. We love A-B testing. We love focus groups. We love surveys. There's a lot of other things you can do. I'm just saying, let's also look at eye tracking. It's a great low-cost technology to really analyze very quickly what might be right or wrong with your web design. Now, Stefan, over to you. Can you explain what's going on with this Bombay chart?
Absolutely. Well, for those few who haven't listened to us talk about eye tracking before, as you can probably guess, the brighter the color, the more attention a space on the page receives. The purple X's show us where people click, and the red line, that's the fold. So in that context, you can see that people paid quite a lot of attention to the horizontal navigation on the top. They paid some attention to those category or messaging along the bottom of the image, but they paid extraordinarily little attention to the image itself. And in fact, if you see that that headline in there about French flair, almost no one spent any real time looking at that.
Yeah, no one read that headline.
And we see something in that that's quite common, with images creating a kind of wall of attention. Now, it's important to remember that an image may still do its job, even though, you know, on face value it seems that it doesn't. It really depends on what the job of the image is. If, as with Bombay, it's all about, you know, communicating that Bombay brand, it does that, because really the mind and the eye only need a fraction of a second to sort of glance at something, get relevant, you know, establish relevance, and then move on to other kinds of content. So on a page like this, it may well be doing its job. The concern, though, is for those websites that do put any sort of internal navigation or kind of try to put meaningful messaging inside these large images, there is a risk of those being lost.
Mm-hmm. I think this really shows you another thing as well, and that is that consumers are treating e-commerce sites, and you'll see on the next slide as well that it seems to be the case, consumers are treating e-commerce sites in a very different way than they treat print catalogs and in a very different way than they treat brick-and-mortar retail stores. What you're seeing is very little browsing activity. I mean, I know when I sit down with a catalog, and in fact there are eye tracking studies from the catalog industry, that if you are sending a catalog in particular to your house list, they're really looking at the images. They're really examining it. They're saying, should I buy this? They're enjoying that browsing, shopping activity. And the same thing happens with a lot of shoppers, of course, in brick and mortar, of course, depending on the kind of store you have. But they're coming in and they're enjoying the environment. They may be sort of examining a lot of different things. You know, you're in the mall, it's a Saturday afternoon, you're enjoying yourself. This is almost an entertainment activity. It doesn't seem to be the case with online e-commerce, according to the eye tracking studies. Now, we studied, was it 8 different e-commerce stores, including Amazon, eBay, a whole bunch of them. Most of them, you didn't see that kind of entertainment activity. And what I think is interesting is I think a lot of some e-commerce marketers are making the assumption that the entertainment mindset is there. Certainly Bombay, with that big gorgeous picture, is sort of thinking, well, we know our Bombay shopper, they love to look at these beautiful pictures. But indeed, people barely glanced at it. What are people doing instead? They're looking at the navigation. And we see consistently people just go zooming right to the navigation, pretty much ignoring anything else. So they're treating the e-commerce site as a search engine, as a search tool. You are not a store. You are a search tool to get to where people want to go. Why don't we move on and look at the next page? This is page 6 of our download. Now, this is Walmart's homepage. Now, Stefan, when people came to look at this in our study group, what were the directions they were given?
Well, in this case, they were given an open budget and a free search. So you've got $200, go crazy.
In other words, so they weren't told to do anything. They could, they had $200, they could just go set.
That's right. In some of the other research, we had them do directed searches because we wanted to look at how they viewed search, internal search and product pages.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of home pages, we could let them go wild. And what I think absolutely supports what you were just saying, you can see that even in this scenario where someone's got, you know, $200 they didn't know they had and no obligations to go look for something specific, that's still almost immediately what they do. They go right for the navigation, whether it's the horizontal tabs across the top or the vertical, they get roughly equal attention. The horizontal wins by a nose. But you don't see a lot of browsing behavior even in this scenario. You know, people pay a little bit of attention to the various headlines, but nothing significant. They certainly aren't using the homepage as, you know, to give them ideas as much as going to areas that they're already interested in.
The homepage really is purely a navigation device as opposed to almost anything else. Now, actually, last night, in fact, an e-commerce marketer called me and asked, they were having an argument in-house about whether they should be focusing on their horizontal nav bar or their vertical one, which one was more important. And so that's interesting advice that you really still need both. And then, indeed, for your most critical areas of your store, you probably should have them in both of the nav bars because you never know which one someone's going to look at.
That's absolutely
right. So you can have them
represented
in both places. Yeah.
I think some people, you know, some people are tab people, some people are list people.
Mm-hmm. That makes perfect sense. And the other thing that we see here is that not a heck of a lot of attention paid to images. Again, I sort of thought the images would be so much more interesting than, you know, boring old tabs and navigation. But they're really not getting sucked in by the images here. Now, Stefan, you had said that there was some data around images and the scroll line.
There absolutely is. In several of these eye tracking studies, we've noticed a possible phenomenon, and that is it appears that on pages where the typical fold, and of course the fold does vary, but you know most people are in you know a couple of different resolution groups. Anyway, the point is that when you cut an image in half, it seems like it encourages people to scroll more. Whether it's a subconscious thing, we don't know. But it appears that having something that's cut in half seems to, you know, open up a, you know, what's down there in people's minds, and
mm-hmm.
we see it somewhat more scrolling. So mm-hmm. it's a possibility for site designers to experiment with.
That's cool. There's something else that I'm noticing here, and I think I've seen this in some of the other eye tracking studies you've been doing, and that is that one of the clicks, is actually on the far left, on the left down toward the bottom near the video game section of Walmart navigation bar, they're clicking on something that isn't actually clickable. Now, does that happen a lot?
Oh, it happens all the time. In fact, this is an unusual example because so little random clicking takes place. We typically will see, you know, 10-15% of the clicks clicks to nowhere.
Wow. So if you're designing a site, should you make your click length bigger or should you make things that are white space clickable? I'm not sure.
I don't know about making white space clickable. Certainly in any kind of menu, making that whole row clickable to the appropriate category might make sense. But, you know, you can only design so much. And if people are clicking on white space, they may not really be looking to go anywhere.
Okay. So certainly you want to make your images clickable.
Absolutely. Images have to be clickable. One other thing before we move off this page is something we've noticed about how people engage with search. You sort of see an example here in these text links on the left-hand side. Typically, we find that people aren't very into advanced search. They don't use the different capabilities of the internal search engines.
Mm-hmm.
But we have seen some success in using text links on category pages. For instance, breaking down all of the possible digital camera results by you know, pixel density, by brand, that kind of thing. So kind of taking some of those advanced search capabilities and putting them into menu form.
Okay, so people will use ordinary search they'll use, but they won't use that advanced search. And then, again, it's sort of like, you know, text link marketing or pay-per-click. Most of the pay-per-click marketing these days, text links work. People read text. Why don't we move on to the next page? Page 7, which is all about internal search. This one fascinated me. It makes intuitive sense when you think about it, that if someone comes to your store, if they use the search function, if they use that search box, they're, well, it appears here, more than twice as likely to convert into buying something than if they don't use the search box. Now, of course, Stefan, when your team, you guys actually went out and looked at 100 different e-commerce sites and examined how many of them had the search box very prominently placed, and you found that it was nearly 100%?
It was pretty close to 100%, which is unusual because even in something as well known as the importance of search, you know, every best practice tends to have its, you know, 20% of people who do something else. And so this just tells you something about how important retailers are finding the internal search box. They get it. And 96% have a search box above the fold. And that remaining 4% has search, but it's simply not as prominent.
Okay, so you got to move that above the fold if you are in the 4% that don't have it up there. But the other thing that I'm wondering about is, you know, how can you then take it and make it more effective? I mean, I shop e-commerce a lot. I buy nearly every single item of apparel that I own via e-commerce. I buy a lot of other stuff via e-commerce. I just bought my wedding invitations via e-commerce. Everything's e-commerce for me, and I am really frustrated a lot of the time with the search results. I'll type in something that I think is perfectly clear, and, of course, the search result will come back, and it will say, you know, query string not found, or, you know, no results for this, zero. It'll say zero. You know, it'll be kind of this blank white page with maybe standard navigation, but just sort of a negative term. And I think if you're somebody, it's almost the equivalent of a, you know, 404 page, file not found. And I'm wondering whether marketers could do a better job of that search term not found, search term doesn't work, zero results page. If you could use that page a little more effectively to perhaps market something at the very least, or give text links to things that they, some suggestions for another place to go. The other thing I know that we've done are quite a few case studies on search results layout. This seems to be, if you're going to be upgrading your site, the layout of your internal search results page seems to be one of the absolutely the most critical places to put some redesign energy into and to put some A/B testing energy into. You're going to want to test how many images, if you have multiple images show up, often people will have anywhere from 10 to 20 thumbnails show up with different products that folks can choose from to move on to the product page of their choice. If you're going to have multiple merchandise images, how many should you have? How much text should be next to them? Do you just have hot links, or should you have buttons next to them? Should you have prices on them or not? Should you be able to click on that image and have it be bigger? All different angles you can get there. The one piece of data we do have is, of course, just like regular search, most consumers do not go to page 2 of your search results internally. So if they don't see what they want pretty much in the first 3 or 4 images or items they see in your internal site search results, they give up. They either go back to your homepage and start searching again, or they say, oh, forget it, and go to another site. So how are you arranging which of the search results shows up first? Is it just by price? Is it by whatever entered your database? What SKU is the newest SKU? Is it by bestseller? Is it, you know, how is it? Is it by the most related to the thing they entered? There are a lot of different ways of doing that. So saying, how am I going to display these search results? Absolutely A/B test the living daylights out of that. And then say, and how am I going to figure out which merchandise item, which SKU is going to show up first? Also, last but not least, if you have multiple SKUs that are all with the same image, I just had that. I was shopping for sheets the other day, and there were several SKUs that all had the exact same photograph. So there I am, and I got search results, and it looked like, you know, 5 of the same thing. And I thought, oh, well, you know, there's no variety here. I can't find what I want, and I left. Only later I realized they actually were showing 5 different things, but they all happened to use the same image. You may want to make sure that that isn't happening. So I think there's a lot of a lot of experimentation and best practices around internal site search results that can improve conversions like crazy. And if you are doing this stuff, let us know. I'd love to write some more case studies about it. Why don't we move on to page 8? And this is, here's the good stuff. Performance of site tests and tweaks. Remember when we said earlier that, if you're spending the majority of your budget on web redesign, or you've got a big slice of your budget aimed at your website, what should you be investing in for this year? Well, this chart shows you. Stephen, can you talk us through it?
Absolutely. And just as a side note, we did an awful lot of, research into different website aspects, and this chart really just is the tip of the iceberg. But so going off what you were just saying about internal search and its foibles, you can see that marketers agree with you. 50%, and it's the second highest percentage after shopping cart tests, 50% are saying that some of the most effective testing they've done have been tweaks of those internal search results pages. And I think we really are going to see a lot of change in the next couple of years, as so many companies which came into search as quickly as they could to be ready are now going into a second or third generation of internal search engines.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, of course, we see that the shopping cart tests perform well. We know that in the last holiday season, even though most e-commerce sites have been around for a while, virtually all online shoppers reported some kind of usability problem that they encounter with a site. And most of those usability problems tend to be around the checkout process. Obviously, this is the last place where you want users to encounter any problems or delays, and we go into some of the practical tests and fixes in the report. At the most basic, the one thing that e-commerce marketers always mention to us is examining each step from clicking on the checkout button through the confirmation of purchase. Look at every step in that and examine very closely whether it needs to be there. Very often the X factor is email registration or registering for a site. A lot of sites have found it worthwhile to put that registration process before the purchase. But of course that does increase the abandonment rate. So others have found it make more sense to put it after the purchase. There are enough marketers in both camps that I don't want to call it a best practice, but at a certain level it does make sense to take out anything that isn't absolutely vital to that specific sale. Of course, if you know that the customer lifetime value of those people who become registered members is substantially higher than the average, then, it's time to look at it the other way. So.
That's great.
Two answers.
You gotta test it, and that really is always the real answer. The thing that I find, I think perhaps most interesting about this page, aside from, whoopee, internal search results pages really do matter. Is it the really fancy stuff? I mean, the super, super fancy stuff, multivariate testing and 3D product displays and Zoom and video and stuff, actually were only 36% of the marketers who tried them said that they were very effective. And we're not saying multivariate testing isn't a great thing. In fact, we've seen some incredible case studies for landing pages and multivariate testing. It works extremely well when you're trying to market one item, someone's landing on that one page and you're focusing on that one activity. And we've also seen multivariate testing work fairly well with email. And I've done some case studies, of course, on product display tools. And, 3D can help and video can help and nifty ways of looking at the product can help. But when it comes down to it, look at the one above. Copy tests. Copywriting. Copywriting is going to be very effective. If you just tweak a few words of copy, that could be worth it. So before you're rushing out perhaps and spending money on the 3D and the multivariate testing, have you really tested your copy to make sure it's as good as it can be? That's amazing to me. Frankly, because if you've got a good copywriter in-house, that costs you nothing. This is not necessarily bells and whistles that are helping convert people. It's good, solid marketing craftsmanship. And I think that's the lesson we all need to learn. It isn't about necessarily the cool technology. It's just great marketing.
That's absolutely true. I mean, one word in defense of multivariate testing is that 96% do find it at least somewhat effective. And I think in part that might be because any kind of multivariate testing tends to be an iterative process where you know, if you look at the overall impact of continuous testing on, say, a landing page or category page, over a couple of years, you'd see some substantial impact. But individual tests may have a more modest impact. But we definitely see that people find it effective, maybe not to the extent that we expected. Are they really enthusiastic about it?
Oh, cool. Now, this next slide, page number 9, speaks to what you were talking about, which is the abandonment rate. Now, frankly, I was a little surprised by this data. I think I've heard a lot of marketers anecdotally, kind of glibly tell me, oh, you know, our abandonment rate's only 20%. It seems to be that, oh, we're pretty sure 80% of the people who try to buy get all the way through our cart. And I had always assumed that an average abandonment rate was about 20% until I saw this data. Can you explain what the average abandonment rate is, Stefan?
Sure. Well, the average is much closer to 60%. And I would, you know, what we find about abandonment is that a large percentage of it, maybe 40%, as high as that, is abandonment you're probably not going to be able to affect. Those are folks who are checking the shipping price. They're not ready to buy, but they're using the checkout as a research tool, essentially.
I see.
But in between there and someone who bought are those people who abandoned and might not have. So those are the golden few that folks are really trying to get at. And so what we did was we compared that, the average reported abandonment rate, for companies that were using different tactics, different ways of approaching the website. And what's interesting is that both using extensive shopping cart design and function tests, or persona-based design and with a combination of site usability, that both of those types of testing brought that average abandonment rate down about 10%. And a quick word, we found that those two groups had a very high degree of overlap. And so it's unlikely that doing both of them as opposed to one or the other is going to have, you know, a 20% positive impact on your abandonment rate.
But even a 10% impact, that's 10% more sales. That's a huge lift.
It's absolutely huge and absolutely essential. And if I had to start a retail site and was looking, I would start with usability testing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fast. It's relatively cheap in comparison with some others. And one of the usability experts that we've, I think we're selling the book, mentioned, no usability test will fail in giving you at least 3 solid actionable items. And well, that's all you can ask out of the test.
So a usability test would be just perhaps sitting down someone, even like your mom, having them go through checkout on your site without you telling them everything. You have to, you know, clamp your lips and just say, please check out, please buy something, and seeing where they waver, seeing what confuses them, and getting some ideas from that.
That's right. A usability test can start with 5 people, and as long as they're not in the company and don't have a vested interest, they use e-commerce from time to time, they're appropriate. So the other interesting data from this was about single-screen checkout. And that's really a sort of a collection of technologies. There are different ways of approaching the problem of people clicking from the product page into the cart and sort of getting, you know, distracted. You know, once they're in line, what are they going to buy? So the single screen checkout technologies allow a sort of dynamic checkout process to exist on the same page with the product. So as you surf through the site, adding, subtracting products to your shopping cart, those items are displayed there for you. Some of the systems actually display a little image, a thumbnail of the different products in the cart.
Is there a particular site that you'd say, hey, go look at that for a good example of this?
Well, and here's the tricky part. Everybody's in testing. So when I note that there's a limited sample, that's true. I believe TJ Maxx is the best known company with some version of this. But it's important for me to note that our sample for this is really very low. So this is intriguing data, intriguing enough that we wanted to include it, but this is not 1,100 marketers speaking, much smaller than.
Okay. Well, there are 2 things that we've been working on case studies on, that we've done case studies on, that help reduce abandonment rate. And the first of which is doing somewhat of a one-page checkout. Cafe Press, who, if you don't know them, you probably should be going and looking at them. They actually are the shopping cart that powers hundreds of thousands of smaller websites shopping. They not only power the shopping, but they also power the products and the fulfillment and the merchandising and the fulfillment. So say you are running a Dilbert fan site, you can sell the Dilbert t-shirts, and Cafe Press will actually print the darn things up and ship them and then just give you a cut on the back end. Or if you're invented your own cartoon, you can make your own t-shirts and Cafe Press will make them for you and ship them. Anyway, they process more than 1 million orders a month, so that's quite a heavy load of e-commerce coming in. And they have less than a 20% abandonment rate, so they have a very small abandonment rate. They did a lot of shopping cart testing about 18 months ago and came up with a cart that actually, when you're checking out, as you answer the questions, as you check out, the page itself, I believe it's Java-driven, changes, and so you don't have to click to another page to find something. It's definitely worth going and checking out, taking some screenshots and showing them to your development group. The other idea that a lot of the bigger and more savvy, in particular the pure play internet retailers, are doing is, of course, the abandonment email program. This is a dynamically generated autoresponder. It is personalized. What happens is when someone abandons the shopping cart, they got partway through the process, so at least you know who they are and hopefully have an email and an opt-in. You can actually ping them with a personalized email that it can be an hour later, it can be a day later, it can be a week later, just, you know, warning them, hey, you know, your card is waiting for you, or hey, 5% off if you continue checking out now. You can test all different sorts of things with these abandonment emails. I know that some marketers are testing a two-stage abandonment program where they'll do one within a day or two, letting them know the card is waiting for them, and giving them perhaps a special offer. And then they also ping them if they still haven't bought about 30 days later to say, your cart is about to be wiped out. You know, it's not going to be in the database anymore. It's not going to be saved anymore. So this is your last chance to come by and buy things. And that seems to work fairly well, too. So I like that email. Not every email service can do it. And I've actually been warned kind of behind the scenes that some of the email service providers who say they can do it can't quite do it. So you really do have to ask, can they power dynamically generated, personalized, automated email? It's kind of a mouthful, but it's worth talking to them about that. Now, why don't we move on to the next slide, and that is page 10. What is motivating consumers? Now, this is interesting, in particular interesting because so many of them like these shopping comparison sites, which practically nobody's investing any money in on the merchant side. Now, Stefan, can you describe where we got this data from?
Absolutely. Well, this was from our cooperative study, a survey of over 1,120 consumers who had responded that they did some online shopping during the holidays. And a very representative sample using the Greenfield Online sample set. So we feel pretty good about this data. And what's really interesting is that the overlap of people who use shopping comparison sites and those people who say that they had a profound impact on, or they had a strong impact on their holiday purchase, is almost a 100% match. In other words, while a lot of people did searches, probably only about 37% said that they were influenced by one specifically. But
you mean regular search like on Google or Yahoo?
Regular search.
Uh-huh.
Meanwhile, almost everyone who did a comparison shopping search is saying, yes, and it affected my purchase.
In other words, they're further down the sales cycle if
exactly.
They're choosing to use that particular shopping site, which would imply they're more valuable as a shopper. On one hand, they're more likely to convert. On the other hand, could they be less loyal?
Well, there is interesting data about that because we also asked people whether they're the kind of shopper that likes a few specific sites. And
Or are they just a dollars-off shopper?
Or are they a dollars-off shopper? And there's actually a fairly high correlation between people, and this is surprising, people who use shopping comparison sites and still say, yes, there are still sites that are my favorites, and I'm pretty loyal to them. So, there is some question there, but I think that what it suggests is that people are using the shopping comparison sites to quickly scan price, but they're still going to known brands most of the time to do that shopping.
Mm-hmm. So they're further down the sales cycle, and they may not just be using it to save money. They may just be using it because they think of it as a shopping search engine.
That's right.
Which is indeed what it is.
We also asked them about sort of red flags in using the comparison site. And those who use the engines regularly were substantially more likely to be suspicious of prices that were, quote, too low. And you know, very frequently you'll see, you know, prices that are more than, let's say, 10 or 15% away from the average.
Mm-hmm.
And shopping comparison site users are definitely wary of those. You know, sometimes it's just a company trying to get volume in a specific product category. But unless you're a known website, there is some danger in having prices that actually scare people away because they're so low.
All right, so if you're a famous name brand, you can get away with the serious discounting. But if you're perhaps a brand no one's ever heard of, they still may not click on you.
That's right. Some of the other factors were website design having a significant impact. And interestingly, the location.
So it's all about the landing page.
It's all about the landing page. It's how, you know, there really is a, you know, in the retail world, people talk about the atmosphere of a store. I think that really does apply online. The lessons may be very different. You know, simplicity, cleanliness, you know, all about high functionality and design. But people definitely take notice, and they very quickly form an opinion of a website.
Mm-hmm.
Colors, flashing banners, they don't like those either. Well, mm-hmm. not all color, but flashing banners, too many ads, definitely a red flag for comparison shopping.
Well, let's move on. Page 11, what's in a welcome message? Now, I actually just finished. I was on the committee that judged our annual email marketing awards. And one of the things that really surprised me the most about the email marketing awards was I hadn't expected so many entries in the welcome message category. We were just flooded with folks who are testing all sorts of really interesting tactics for their autoresponder that goes out when somebody first opts into a list. It seems that that very simple transactional kind of you have been subscribed to this list is out the door, and especially in e-commerce, folks are doing very neat stuff, such as the sample we see here in the upper left corner, which is from Dutch Gardens. And that is a welcome message. That is a, you know, thank you for subscribing to our list. Now get free shipping. So people are testing that, and the data that I saw from all the entries was really outstanding. I mean, this is just a very high impact tactic to test. But it looks from here, from this data, that unlike awards nominees, the average e-commerce marketer is not taking advantage of the power of the welcome message.
That's absolutely right. Now, to be clear, we used the very first email from a marketer as the basis for this comparison. So a lot of marketers do use a very dry confirmation message and then follow that up relatively quickly with a different kind of message, a more salesy marketing oriented message. But the fact is that that's not the welcome message. It's that very first email that typically sees the highest open rates of any of the major categories of email. So it may not matter that your second email is a brilliantly designed, wonderful retail experience, because it's that first message that people are more likely to open. So in looking at it, we found that the vast majority weren't taking any real advantage of it. Most disturbingly, 26% didn't send any sort of initial confirmation within 48 hours.
So your researchers actually went to these retailers' sites and signed up their email address, and they got nothing?
They didn't receive a confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
They did eventually receive emails from virtually all of them. But in some cases, they were simply put into the email queue for the next mailing.
Right, they were just slammed in the regular house pile. Yeah.
Exactly, which is a definite, worst practice because, you know, those recent subscribers, typically open and click on, email messages substantially more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as would be expected. You know, I mean, they're there for a reason. And while you've got their interest, it really pays to take advantage of them. So in this slide, we see that a very tiny percentage, 2%, actually had specific sort of products, sales, et cetera.
So I guess that 2% all entered our contest. And, I would like to see that number go up next year. It's just pitiful. And the nice thing is it is such a nice, high responding effort. And it's not like it's going to cost you any more money. You're probably already sending the message. Just wump it up a little bit. At the very least, add an offer or perhaps a freemium or perhaps here's some useful links. I mean, there's all sorts of great things you can do in a welcome message and test out. And then it's just automatic. It's going out every day, all day. So that ends our e-commerce benchmark guide presentation. To sum up, our top tips included really investigating whether or not the shopping compare search sites are going to be a good deal for you now that a lot of them are allowing bidding on a SKU basis. And now that there is data showing that the customers using them tend to convert a little bit higher and may be more loyal than you suspect. We also suggest paying a great deal of attention to your search results page and also testing out copy on product pages. In addition, testing the navigation elements on your site's design instead of having huge, long committee discussions about what should go in the middle of the page, the bottom of the page, the right side of the page. It's really that top navigation and the left navigation that do matter in the end. I know that we've all known this, but, you know, we all end up in the same committee meetings anyway. And, of course, examine your email program to make sure that you really are sending, first of all, some kind of offer in your welcome message. And then second of all, perhaps testing some type of shopping cart abandonment email. Stefan, any final takeaways from you?
Just to not forget about email. I think in the last 18 months, there's been so much pressure to become expert search marketers for everyone that email may have been ignored. And if we think back to that slide on what affected consumers purchasing in the 2005 holiday season, email still wins by a nose, 38-37.
Now, if you're interested in learning more about the e-commerce benchmark guide, we do have a free PDF download. Just go to our store, it's SherpaStore.com, and click on the free stuff tab, which is right at the top right corner, and you'll find a PDF download with the executive summary from this guide, which includes, I believe it's 6 more charts from the guides. They're new, in addition to this presentation, and it also has a table of contents. And thank you to everyone who helped us with our case studies and who took our survey so that we would have data from 1,100 e-commerce marketers, real life data in this report. Thank you so much.